Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. We have a little different schedule today. I have a guest today, David Krieger of Hobson NBT, and David has joined us several times for the past couple of years on the program, and we've talked about gold and the markets and different types of coins. And today we're going to go off topic a little bit for the first 20 minutes of the program, as David Krieger also has an extensive military background, and I thought it would be interesting to get his views and takes on what is going on in so many different parts of the world. And it seems like with the news, the outbreak of Ebola here in the country, a lot of these big news stories kind of have just lost their place, as everyone is talking about Ebola, not ISA and the borders anymore, or at least they're out of the news as the top liners for the next week or so. So we're going to bring his view on those. And remember that Alfred Addisk will be joining James Corbett of the Corbett Report for the second and third segment of the program. And let's get started right away, because we want to, we only have 20 minutes. Today is Thursday, October 2nd, 2014. Before we go into the market report, I just want to say good afternoon, David, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, Melody. It's great to be with you again.
And so we'll be talking about ISIS and a lot of things. There's a $5 billion, $5 billion that sort of just has gone missing, and no one knows what to do. And you're going to give us all the details. But first, let's see what gold has done today. We have gold up a dollar at $1,215. Silver's down 7 cents today at $17.20. Platinum was down $15 at $12.71, along with palladium down 11 at $770. The USDX today is trading down slightly lower, 0.23 at 85.65. You have a little bit of a lower dollar index. The European Union came out today and made the euro go up a little bit, so you have a little bit of pressure on the dollar. And, of course, crude oil is up slightly, 0.57 at 91.30. Paper markets had a difficult time today, staying in the positive territory. You have the Dow that is down 3.66 at 16,801. The NASDAQ did manage to be up 8%. barely at 44.30, and the S&P basically unchanged at 1946. 10-year yield did pop a little bit, 0.03 at 2.44%. So, you know, gold prices ended this session not much different from yesterday. It was kind of a quiet trading day. Everyone is waiting for the key employment report that's coming out tomorrow. So everybody's holding their breath. That is probably the most important economic report of the month, if you believe all their numbers. And you had the central bank, as I mentioned, the European Central Bank. They made no changes to their monetary policy at its monthly meeting today. And, of course, we saw a little bit of pressure on the U.S. dollar, as I had mentioned, and with a little bit of strength in the euro. The Eurozone producer price index, that was down a little bit in August from July. So, you know, it might be another clue they might worry about deflation. And that only means more stimulus with their quantitative easing that they'll be putting into the markets. So that's pretty much it on the economic side. We'll see what happens tomorrow with those numbers. If they're, you know, it's an election year, David, I think those numbers until the election will probably be a little to the, you know, good side, to the soft side, nothing real drastic. If anything drastic happens, then all bets are off and, you know, things could unfold quicker than what we would anticipate.
Isn't that been the history, though? All of a sudden, you know, we're going along, and all of a sudden things just take off. And it'll be interesting to see what happens. I agree with you. It's always interesting listening to your market report, Melody, and it is amazing how everything that you have just talked about, in some way, if you are interested in national security, these all apply to national security, even when you're talking about such things as the jobs numbers or what gold is doing or what the stock market's doing. And I'm afraid sometimes people just don't get tuned in enough as to what those effects are on our national security and keeping us safe.
Well, explain that a little bit more as far as keeping us safe in our national security. And you're right, I do these numbers every day, and sometimes you just repeat them. And sometimes they don't seem to mean anything anymore because we know most or all the markets are rigged. And
Well, I guess what I'm thinking about is a couple things. One is I saw an article this morning which I found personally interesting. It was a story on what you gave a little teaser on a couple minutes ago. It was the fact that when President Obama in May went up and spoke at the West Point graduation, or he was up there for West Point to make a major speech on terrorism, and he took the occasion to do that. He made an announcement that he was going to have $5 billion set aside to fight terrorism. Now, this $5 billion, a fair amount of money, but in hindsight, I think this shows us the way that the current administration thinks or really doesn't long-term plan. Basically, that $5 billion was with three objectives in mind. One was to train security forces in Yemen. Now, I have to ask if that's really high on the list, but the other one was training security forces and border patrols in Libya. And the third was helping the French, possibly the French, operations in Mali. So $5 billion just kind of thrown off in there. And it's been 4 months. The Pentagon story that was in today's paper says, hey, they have no clue what the plan is. In addition, when the president went to Poland shortly after that, he made another announcement and threw it at the Pentagon, was another billion for what he called the European Reassurance Initiative. And I don't think anybody in the Pentagon really understands what that means. And essentially, the Pentagon today is kind of wrunning their hands, rubbing their hands together, and saying what the administration is doing is saying, okay, look, here's the money. Go figure out what you're going to do with it. And that has just crystallized in my mind the problem that we have in our country here of this just uncontrolled spending to throw something at it and figure out what's going to happen later on. And that, to me, as we're talking about our money supply, is a national security issue. It seems backwards. It seems unregulated, and it seems to meet what much of the criticism has been, that the current administration will say something, and if they say it, if they believe that it's true and it's going to happen, and they forget about carrying out the plan or following up. So that's what I'm getting at.
Well, you know, I was talking to someone yesterday, and it's true that, I mean, there's no leadership coming down from the top. We get that. He's unable. But you would think that, you know, from the Pentagon and the heads of those departments for our national security, and, you know, we just had, you know, that lady, the presidential security, you know, she resigned yesterday or the day before. But you would think that these heads of these various departments would take their positions a little more seriously and lead, but they're not doing that. So is it, do they want it to collapse from the top as far as politics and those departments? And
no, I think it's simpler than that. Yeah, I do. I think it's simpler than that. I had the distinct honor of being head of the entire Navy promotion system for almost 3 years at one time in my career. And so I was in Washington, and part of my job was to take admirals into a room to choose new admirals, and then to do the administration to promote from qualified people a very small number of admirals each year, and to watch those admirals go up through the ranks. Now, that's a very competitive system. But I've always had kind of a negative view of what happens when somebody makes 4 stars and is appointed to chairman of the Joint Chiefs, deputy chief of staff of the Army, the Air Force, chief of naval operations, the Army chief of staff, these really key jobs that supposedly go have people in it that can walk into the White House, talk to the president direct without any interference, or certainly pound their hands on the desk of the Secretary of Defense. I think that because those choices are made by the White House, as recommended by the Defense Secretary, that there's too much politics that come into it. And so you get people who are not going to speak up. They really enjoy that 4-star power that's in there. And I think it's really been a very negative effect on our military for probably since the days of Clinton.
Interesting. So they can throw $5 billion at it, and this is why we see the increased problems we have in Iraq with ISIS and you name it, with the things that are happening.
I guess what I'm saying,
it's just all time.
What I'm saying is something different. I'm saying that if the $5 billion was to go to train security forces in Yemen, do border patrol in Libya, and help the French in Mali, and, you know, what are we doing in Syria other than some, you know, selective air campaign? It doesn't make any sense to me. I think our priorities are really wrong.
So you think that ISIS is just going to continue to grow and continue to take over and accomplish?
I would hope not. But
I hope not.
You know, one of the discussions is, well, let's go find some moderates in Syria. And one of the real questions is, well, what's the definition of a moderate in Syria? I mean, is that somebody that you know, believes in strong democratic institutions, or are these guys that promise that they'll never eat another heart on TV? Is it somebody that you know, they can certify doesn't have a complete hate for the United States? I mean, what is a moderate? I don't think there is one in Syria. They must be very hard to find.
Well, today I saw that Moshe Obama is going around and going to bat for Senate Democrats, and she's warning them that the control of the chamber and the potential Republican, that there's a potential Republican impeachment. and that there's only a few votes away from that. Is that true? Do you think that's?
Well, I would hope that's not the case. I think I'd hate to see the entire government shut down over an impeachment thing. In other words, that would be all over the paper, and we wouldn't be seeing anything else. I don't think that would be a good move at this point. I would just hope that people in Kansas pick carefully their next senator, and I would hope that Americans understand that in order to get anything done, we're going to have to replace Harry Reid and get a majority of conservatives in the Senate to at least cause something to look like it's moving. Very important, I think, for 2016.
So what would you say is the the best attack on ISIS, and how is that going to play out?
Well, I don't know. I'm probably in the minority, but I really thought that Bill O'Reilly the other night on Fox News hit a home run. If we are not going to send in American troops, his proposal was to come up with a mercenary force. You know, that's the word he used, and basically paid for by countries that are in favor of getting rid of ISIS. Now, I thought at first, well, you know, that'll never happen, and it probably won't. But when you stop to think that in Iraq, one of the most successful ways of getting people secured and safe, whether they be the Secretary of Defense visiting or diplomatic people moving back and forth, was using this company called Blackwater. Now, yeah. Blackwater got some bad publicity towards the end, but they were very effective. And they were ex-military, paid very well, and carried out a mission that the American military was neither trained to do nor had the ability to do. And I would think that if Obama isn't going to do anything with American troops on the ground, that would be a viable idea.
A comment came in from Frank the producer. He says that's what Rome did just before it fell, hired mercenaries.
Unfortunately, yes, absolutely. Yep.
So is that a sign where we're at?
Well, you're going to get me in all kinds of trouble tonight, LD.
I'm
one of those people that believe we're in the end times, you know. So.
We only have 3 minutes to go, so make it good, David.
Well, I think it's sad. I think that I listen to a lot of people saying we're war weary. I agree. I've had two boys that have served. One was over for 3.5 years in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and so in our family we're deeply affected by that, and I would not want to see him go back. But that said, there's only 1% of our population that's serving in the military. And it's falling away. So I think that it's a very difficult time. I think that we really need to have more people in America attuned to what is going on in the world, and to actually make an informed decision whether or not we want to take on ISIS as a ground, with so-called boots on the ground. I think it's going to come to that sometime, and I think it's unfortunate. The longer we wait, the stronger they become. Think of the money that they're making.
If we have to get to the point of getting mercenaries, I mean, isn't that a sign? And no disrespect to the men and women that are in there, but isn't that a sign that our military is becoming softer?
Well, I don't think that's the case. I think what O'Reilly's point was, and the point I took away from it, was that America does not have a policy of, when we went into Iraq, was not to go in there for oil. I mean, we would have been, that would never work. That would have been a very negative thing. But if you have a so-called mercenary force that's paid for by other countries, then it isn't so much treasure out of America, but it's doing the same thing with a highly skilled force. I don't think it really applies to the American military, which they're trying to hold back. And I didn't take that as a negative on American military. I took it as a negative on long-term presence in other countries as chosen by the current administration.
Well, we're just about out of time. 20 minutes just sort of slips right by. And we have Alfred Addisk and James Corbett joining the listeners here in just a few minutes. I want to thank you for joining me for the 20 short minutes that we did have. And I got a question for you, a quick yes or a no. Should we be concerned about Ebola?
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Do you think, I mean, do you believe that these stories are real? And
I believe that there's a real patient in Dallas right now who's in serious condition.
Well, I believe that, too. Yes.
With his family in an apartment under quarantine, which to me seems, you know, really ridiculous. I mean, what are they doing? They're quarantining in an apartment? People that are known to have been in contact with a person showing symptoms. Now, on cable news this afternoon, we're being assured that this is not a problem and it's all going to go away. But, you know, when the president was down at the CDC last month, he said that people weren't going to be coming in from West Africa into America. It wasn't going to be a problem. And if they do, we know what to do. Well, again, we've been proven that that's not what the case is.
All right. Well, thank
suspicious.
You. All righty, David. Thank you for joining us. Folks, stay tuned for Alfred and James Corbett.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad spectrum immune boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll free 866-229-3663 or online thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663 or thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97%. Of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Are you concerned about prescription drug dependency to stay healthy? Are you worried that the cost and availability of your medications may put your health at risk? Perhaps it's time you consider a natural, safe, and effective way to deal with your health problems. If only you knew where to start. Start right here. Tune in to Herb Talk Live with herbalist Wendy Wilson every Tuesday and Thursday evening, 7 p.m. on AmericanVoiceRadio.com, where your healthcare options just became endless.
Hi, folks, I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Our guest is James Corbett. He's been living in Japan for the past decade. He started a publication called The Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, CorbettReport.com. It's for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. And James is the independent critic behind that analysis. He's also editorial writer for the International Forecaster, a weekly newsletter created by recently deceased Bob Chapman. And he's been on the program here on Thursdays on a regular basis. We've had him now for, I don't know, a couple of months, I guess. I suppose this is probably our eighth interview. Do you suppose that's right, Jim?
You know, it might even be more than that by this point. Yeah, but yeah, we've done a few.
Yeah, we've done a few. I want to start this out with a question that is more personal. It doesn't have anything to do with geopolitics. But I'm just curious. I'm going to guess that you would regard yourself, describe yourself as a communicator. True?
Well, at any rate, that's the role I play. So, yes,
all right, that's the role you play. Well, I'm curious. I know that you write and you also speak. And I'm just curious, are you more comfortable writing or are you more comfortable speaking? Which way do you prefer to communicate? Do you have a preference?
I think I do, but let me ask you your opinion. What do you believe would be my answer to that?
It's hard to say. You have a capacity for speech that is almost extraordinary. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you like it as much as you
like. Yeah.
All right. Maybe maybe you prefer writing even despite your ability to speak. And I was curious.
Well, thank you for the question. It's an interesting one. I very much appreciate that because I certainly, if people go back to listen to my earliest podcasts, I was not nearly so eloquent or interesting to listen to. So this is something that I've really trained myself into over several years. But my first love was and has always been writing. In fact, when I was younger, I really thought I was going to become a novelist or something along those lines. I really did want to be a writer. So I think that's been my first love. And something that I've had all my life. The idea of me speaking into a microphone is relatively new. I don't mind doing it. I've grown to sort of enjoy and appreciate the ability to do this, but I would say writing is kind of my first passion.
I'm not surprised. I don't think you could learn to speak with the same level of precision that you enjoy if you hadn't first learned to write with a certain level of precision. If you understand, I don't know if that makes sense to you, but
no, I think that is correct because obviously the vocabulary, the diction, all of that comes really from having read an awful lot and written quite a bit over the years as well. So,
I was talking in the first part of the program. I started doing radio programs perhaps 15 years ago, something like that, and I did them all by myself. And I was on small operations, and they had such a terrible soundboard. I would try to have guests. But if I could hear the guest couldn't hear me. You understand? And if he could hear me, I couldn't hear him. Yeah. And it was such a stressful thing trying to conduct an interview when you can't hear what the other guy's saying.
I can imagine.
I mean, it's just extraordinary. So I started doing programs all by myself. And I learned quickly how disturbing it is to speak all by yourself when you're not getting any feedback. You do program on radio all by yourself, just a monologue. And nobody's applauding, nobody's nodding, nobody's grunting, nobody's doing anything. Very difficult to speak all by yourself. And I wondered if you had run into a similar experience or not.
I would say certainly yes. I mean, when I first started doing this, obviously I had no experience whatsoever speaking extemporaneously or even using words like extemporaneously off the top of my head. But again, that was all just through trial and error and experience. But I had the great fortune of having done a podcast primarily in which I could go and edit. And trust me, there was an awful lot left on the cutting room floor at the end of every recording session, which was obviously better on my listeners' ears. But again, it's taken an awful long time to be able to now just speak off the top of my head and to have it come out in coherent sentences. So I figure that's enough of an accomplishment. But I still, of course, have my verbal crutches and other things that people love to point out. So I'm working on it at all times.
It's not just a matter of being able to present a coherent sentence. It's a matter of being able to present a series of coherent paragraphs. And it's far more complex, and I'm sure you appreciate that. Average person doesn't realize how much thought. I mean, I'm impressed when you start speaking, you can go on. It's not, a lot of people can talk
and
a long
on
time.
And on.
yeah. But a lot of people can talk, they can babble on for a long time, but they don't make much sense. You can structure your thoughts in a way that really take us, it's almost like a small essay when you answer some of the questions. And I absolutely
appreciate
how much intelligence goes behind that. I know how much work that requires and discipline. And so I just wanted to ask about it a little bit.
Well, thank you for that. And to a certain extent, I think I can't really take credit for that. I think it's just the way that I'm wired. And I remember a psychological test that we took back in school way back in the day that grouped people into I think, four quadrants. There was linear and abstract thinking and concrete and something else. And those were the four terms to play around with, and you could group them in like linear abstract or concrete, whatever. I can't remember the different groupings, but I remember being in the least popular or the least common of those four groupings. And basically my mind seems to work in a way that I can deal with abstract concepts, but I deal with them in a very linear manner. So if I'm thinking through something, I have a certain logic to it, but I'm able to sort of take leaps of thinking about things in an abstract or philosophical way. So it's an interesting combination of things that I hope makes me at least somewhat unique. But I sympathize with the audience's position in this, because I certainly, before I started getting into this, I had no idea. When you're listening to someone speak, you can point out all of the various things that they're doing wrong, and they maybe trail off on a sentence, or they take a leap of logic, or what have you. It's very easy to point that out. But when you actually start trying to do it yourself, you realize how difficult it is to form a coherent paragraph while speaking. Yep.
That's exactly right. It's just astonishing. I said the same thing earlier, and I've said it for years. For me, doing a radio program all by myself, don't even guess, is not all that difficult. But you do a program all by yourself, it's like stepping into a boxing ring, and you got to fight your way through it and see if you can go the distance. And it makes it interesting. I mean, this is a contest of sorts. When I'm doing these programs, if I do one all by myself, I am fighting myself, in a sense, to see if I can maintain that coherence throughout the whole hour. Can I start out and go from point A to B to C to D to E and get to the end of the hour and having made some sense, or does it fall apart? And sometimes I do and sometimes I don't, but it's always interesting to me. Let's move on to something more interesting to everyone else, perhaps. And question, here's something, this is from Natural News. Why does the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, own a patent on Ebola? Are you aware of this?
I am indeed. In fact, I covered this back in my Ebola podcast, back in episode 293 of my podcast called The Ebola Effect. And I did point out in that yes, the CDC does own a patent on a specific strain of Ebola.
Yep.
In fact, not the specific strain that we are encountering in this most recent outbreak. It's the, I believe, the Guinea 2014 EBOV strain of the Ebola disease, which is a member of the Zaire lineage, which again is not the currently operative strain that's passing around in West Africa. So what the question obviously everyone has, why does the CDC own the patent to this? And there's been a lot of speculation as to, does this mean that that the CDC is creating these diseases or what have you?
Well, but normally, legally, a patent is there for the inventor or creator of a product. Same thing with a copyright.
Yes.
It's made available only to the creator. They're the only ones who are supposed to be able to get these. So it's a pretty interesting question.
It is, but unfortunately, this actually leads us into the murky world of biotech and the fact that this dates back to a 1980 U.S. Supreme Court ruling, Diamond v. Chakrabarty, where I believe at that time it was about the patenting of a certain type of bacteria that could eat oil. And I think this was being proposed as a way of trying to clean up oil spills and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, the argument was that you can patent living things if you are able to isolate or do something novel or unique to it. So basically, by isolating or getting a strain of this Ebola virus or whatever it may be in a laboratory condition, you can patent it as a result of the fact that you've done something novel to acquire this or to get a particular strain or what have you. And that's the basis on which they're doing this. But we have to keep it in historical perspective and realize that the CDC has a number of patents to a number of different diseases. And for example, just in my preliminary research that I did for the podcast episode, I was able to dig up a 2003 article that showed that the CDC had patented the SARS virus back in the day. People might remember that SARS scare from originated, I believe, in Hong Kong. And back at that time, back in 2003, 2004, the CDC had patented it. And their official explanation why, I mean, this was actually covered by NBC and all the major affiliates at the time, why are they doing this? And their explanation is that if they don't patent it, then someone in the private sector will. And if someone in the private sector patents something like a strain of Ebola, that means that people who want to research that strain of Ebola will have to actually license that from the patent holder and will have to pay in order to conduct that research. But if the CDC does it, they can make it public domain and everyone can equally do it. So that's the official reason for why they do this. It's nothing new and it doesn't actually pertain to the current Ebola outbreak because it's a different strain entirely.
But it lays the foundation for conspiracy theories that are going to go on for the next 20 years, probably. Yeah. I've got one here from Ms. Shedlock's Global Economic Analysis, and the headline is "Come Hell or High Water, Promise Morphs into Infinity and Beyond." That's the headline. And he says, in 2010, Vice President Joe Biden publicly vowed that the U.S. would be totally out of Afghanistan, come hell or high water, by 2014. Just a few short months, 2014 will be gone. Are U.S. troops out of Afghanistan? Nope. Iraq? Nope. Instead, we have troops in Syria. Now, this makes an interesting, he goes on, he says, political promises should never be believed, but it really does make an interesting point. We've not only gotten into the Middle East, we seem to be getting in deeper and more extensively. I know we don't have as many troops over there as we did, I get that, but you have to wonder, are we going to, and what is really going on? Is this a quagmire that we want to get out of and we just can't quite do it? Or are we intentionally expanding our presence in the Middle East?
Yes, I would say that this is all part and parcel of a long-term strategy to highly involve ourselves, and ourselves, I don't even know why I adopt that term, the American government and its allies in that region and to ensconce them in it for a long time to come. I think that's always been part of the plan. That's why Afghanistan was invaded in the first place. Obviously, the pretext of 9/11 was a convenient pretext, but we have to keep in mind that the invasion orders for Afghanistan was the first major national security decision of the Bush presidency, and the paperwork was on Bush's desk waiting to be signed on September 4th, 2001, 1 week before 9/11. So that's something I've pointed out a number of times, and I've linked directly to the NSPD order that sources from, so that people can go and look for them for it themselves on CorbettReport.com and see that, in fact, the Afghanistan invasion was planned well in advance and was only executed as a result, a convenient result of what happened on 9/11. The ultimate long-term plan has to do with, obviously, with a lot of different geostrategic and geopolitical considerations, one of which, I mean, that has come out in recent years that a lot of people have pointed out to is that Afghanistan, as it turns out, is the quote-unquote Saudi Arabia of lithium, an extremely important and extremely increasingly scarce resource that's important for a lot of modern industrial processes and manufacturing. But I think beyond that, Afghanistan is extremely important on the grand chessboard for a lot of different reasons, not least of which because it is by far the world's largest supplier of opium. In fact, depending on the year and depending on the crop, as much as 94% of the world's heroin ultimately sources from Afghanistan opium. And that has not only continued under the NATO occupation, but has in fact reached record high after record high. Seemingly every single year, new record amounts of poppies are being cultivated and grown and ultimately processed and shipped out of the country, or shipped out of the country and processed, depending on the factors at play. But that, again, it sounds conspiratorial, but you have even Geraldo there on the ground in Afghanistan a few years ago filing a report with some of the U.S. Military that was there to specifically protect the poppy crops and the poppy farmers. And they say, oh, it really grinds our gut that we have to do this, but if we don't do it, then the Taliban will get their hands on the money from this, so we have to help these farmers to grow their crop. So again, I mean, I think we have to look well beyond what's being portrayed in the headlines here, but it is absolutely part and parcel of the long-term game plan that the U.S. and its allies are there to stay for a very long time. They didn't build the largest embassy in the world in the so-called green zone of Baghdad because they wanted to get out of that country quickly. And of course, despite all of their talk of pullout and the fact that they pulled out a large contingent of the troops, they certainly left in an awfully large contingent of the so-called private contractors that are really just now a part and parcel of the DOD.
Yeah, they're just mercenaries is what we're talking about. And, well, they're being paid to fight. They're being paid to occupy. Someone has intentions here that are not being presented to the American people. We'll talk more about that when we return. Take a break for some commercials. I'm here with James Corbett from The Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. Please stay tuned.
Will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in an untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate in those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad-spectrum immune-boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Or take your chances with the bad boys. Call Apothecary Herbs toll-free, 866-229-3663, or online, thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addis, here with James Corbett from The Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. And we've been talking about Afghanistan, and it's something I'm curious about. I haven't read Zbigniew Brzezinski's work where he discussed Afghanistan, but it's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, that he alleged, argued, concluded, discovered that Afghanistan is the key country if you want to rule the world. Now, I may be exaggerating and misunderstanding, but am I roughly correct that that's what Brzezinski has said? And if so, do you agree with that?
That is roughly correct. It's been a few years since I've read the book, but I have done several reports on it. So, again, this is from a 1997 book by Brzezinski, who, of course, was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor and oversaw Operation Cyclone, in which the U.S. government instigated attacks in Afghanistan in order to get the Soviet Union involved, which is now admitted, the admitted history. Of course, for a long time, they tried to claim that the U.S. response in helping to fund the Afghan jihadis and was a response to the Soviet Union, but in fact, it's the other way around. But anyway, Brzezinski in 1997 wrote a book called The Grand Chessboard, in which he alleged that the area that includes Afghanistan and some of the surrounding countries, which he referred to as the Eurasian Balkans, was really the key piece of the puzzle, or the key square on the chessboard for control of the Eurasian landmass, which he said is basically the requirement for any would-be global superpower. You would have to have control of the Eurasian landmass, and in order to do that, you have to have the Eurasian Balkans under your belt, and Afghanistan is square in that area that he was talking about. And he said it for a number of different reasons, but he wrote directly, quote, of importance from the standpoint of security and historical ambitions to at least three of their most immediate and more powerful neighbors, namely Russia, Turkey, and Iran, with China also signaling an increasing political interest in the region. But, he continued, the Eurasian Balkans are infinitely more important as a potential economic prize. An enormous concentration of natural gas and oil reserves is located in the region, in addition to important minerals, including gold. And that was, again, written in 1997, in which he predicted the first major war of the 21st century would be fought in the Eurasian Balkans as part of the sort of plan to control that area. And lo and behold, 4 years later, I guess he got his wish with the Afghan invasion.
I have a note. It's hard to imagine that a country that is essentially a stack of rocks, the way it's described, with a certain amount of dust and sand thrown in to kind of wedge it into place, that this is a key piece in the geopolitical chessboard. It's very surprising, and yet you think that Brzezinski he's got a point.
I think he does, especially when we put it in that context of not just Afghanistan, but also the surrounding area, which of course starts to lead into the Central Asia and the Caucasus region, which again has been largely ignored by pretty much everyone for a very long time, but I think really is strategic and is going to only become more strategic when you factor in not only the Caspian Sea oil there that's and gas that are extremely important that are but also the pipelines that have to run across the region in order to get that to Europe, which is obviously of increasing concern in this age of worry about Gazprom and whether or not Russia will shut off the gas to Europe. That's increasingly important, and also its position in what's being called the New Silk Road, which is basically a vital connecting artery between Asia and Europe. It's geostrategic for a lot of different reasons, and obviously one of those is as a staging ground and operations base for military, which is why it's been extremely important, some of the things that have been happening under the radar to a large extent, but are nonetheless extremely important, including the U.S. airbase in Kyrgyzstan, which was closed in the last few years in favor of greater Kyrgyz cooperation with the Russians. These are the types of things that not a lot of people are concentrating on, but I think once the dust settles, so to speak, on the Middle East and the attention has started to turn elsewhere, I think Central Asia is going to be increasingly important, because again, that really lies right on the doorstep of Russia and China, and we see the radicalization of a lot of the Muslims in that area really as a dagger pointed at the heart of China and Russia. And that's, I think, at least partly what's behind the increasing radicalization of the Uyghur population in China's northwest Xinjiang province, which is becoming more of a problem for the Chinese authorities. And I think it's just another piece of that geopolitical puzzle that we're going to see more and more of in the coming years.
Let's move on and talk a little about trading yuan for euros. On Monday, the People's Bank of China announced the direct trading of yuan for euros will be allowed in the foreign exchange markets. The move will allow China export European trade and investment to move more freely and without the use of dollars. Now, is this an important event, or is this just evidence of a death by a thousand cuts? Just one of the thousand cuts against the U.S. dollar.
I think this is, I mean, we have to see it in that broader perspective as one of the thousand cuts, but it's a pretty big cut, I think. I mean, this is clearly China at this point is very clearly signaling that they are going to make the yuan fully convertible and are going to continue with this internationalization of their currency, which is obviously an extremely important part of the puzzle for China to start becoming a real financial powerhouse, an economic powerhouse, a place where there will be more direct capital investment and there will be a greater possibility for capital investment coming out of China and elsewhere. And as those markets start to develop, I mean, again, this is not a process that we could say is going to take place in the near future, but in the course of the coming decades, all things being equal, China's markets will start to mature and will start to potentially play a real possible role as a real competitor for U.S. markets, which obviously at this point still dominate world markets. Still, there's no question that the U.S. markets are the most developed and the most wired into the international financial infrastructure in a way that that makes the U.S. Absolutely indispensable in that world financial structure. But obviously, I mean, as China starts to come online, it's just going to be more and more of these types of stories. And as the yuan becomes more convertible and ultimately becomes a player on the world currency markets, I mean, that's when we're going to start to see the real changes starting to take place. And again, this is all things being equal, and will be very interesting to see how the apparatus and machinery of the U.S. Propaganda mill / military industrial complex starts to be wielded more and more towards China specifically. And it'll be interesting to see how that gets wheeled around.
What do you think of the Shanghai Gold Exchange and also silver? I'm not sure if they call it Shanghai Silver Exchange, but there is a Shanghai Gold Exchange. Allegedly will focus on physical gold rather than paper gold. What do you think will come of that?
I think this is extremely important. As you say, it's going to concentrate on physical delivery and will be one of the only major points at which there is that possibility for a price, finding the price of physical gold as opposed to the markets which are dominated by paper gold. So I think it's extremely important in at least getting a window into that, at least in the Asian region, where obviously a lot of the gold buying is centered these days, not only through the central banks like the Chinese central bank, which is furiously importing gold and snapping up gold miners all around the world, but the population, specifically in China, which is increasingly buying more gold. So it's extremely important and extremely interesting development. And I realize that this is already opened, but I haven't seen any of the reports coming out as to the sort of price and whether it's diverging greatly from the paper price. But I think we'll start to see that in the coming months, and it's definitely something we should be keeping our eye on.
Don't we have to see that divergence? Because if they're going to sell their gold on the Shanghai Gold Exchange, they're going to sell physical gold at the paper price, they're going to go broke. Everybody's going to line up to take delivery on this stuff. They're literally giving their gold away. They have to charge a premium on that physical gold, or they're not going to attract anyone to sell their physical gold on that market, and whatever is there is likely to be sold off. In theory, some major banks in the United States could be buying, from my perspective, I won't say this is true, but they could be buying physical gold in Shanghai and using it to back up the paper gold back in New York. They have to get a premium on this, or I think they're going to go out of business. So I'm curious if you've seen any evidence. Are they charging a premium? I mean, somebody's got to do this. Or
no, I agree completely with what you're saying there. There's no doubt that there will be a premium for physical delivery. This is more, as a market, it's more aimed at wholesalers and jewelers and people who buy in large amounts. But I think that the divergence will be obvious and will only further underscore what we've been saying here at the Corbett Report, at the International Forecaster, I'm sure on your program for a number of years, which is that if we had a real handle on the physical price of actual physical deliverable gold, it would be very different than what we're seeing on the markets.
Absolutely.
And this is the whole point of creating market exchanges, is to try to find the actual price that people are willing to pay. And again, I must admit, I don't know what the price they're trading at right now is, but I will look that up and we can hopefully discuss that in more depth next week. But again, I'd be shocked if there wasn't a significant premium.
Yeah, there just has to be. It's almost suicidal if they don't charge a premium for gold, for delivering physical gold. If they don't do that, they're going to be run out of business. They're just selling gold for paper price. I mean, the people who sell paper gold in New York, they're not only relatively rarely, do they actually make physical delivery. These people, if they're going to sell it at paper gold prices, and they are stressing physical delivery, this is not a formula for success. This is one of those things they talk about, the wily Oriental. If they're selling their gold for the paper gold price, they aren't that wily. There's a problem here. What do we got left? A couple minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, something like that. Here's something from Meshedlach again. On September 4th, European Central Bank President Draghi pledged to build up the European Central Bank's balance sheet by another 1 trillion euros. Draghi confirmed asset purchases would include real estate, RMBS, don't even know what that is, to say the truth, real estate, ABS. It would also include a fairly wide range of ABS containing loans to the real economy, but only the senior tranches and the mezzanine tranches, only if there was a guarantee. I'm sure that's hard for the big point is that the Central Bank of Europe has decided that they're going to start buying bonds and other investments, and they're going to increase their balance sheet, and this should put more capital into the economy. It should stimulate the economy, but they were only going to get the good stuff. But according to Meshedlach, now, just 3 weeks later, Draghi wants to buy outright junk, presumably without guarantees. Now, my question is this. What's moving Draghi to change from when he's only going to buy, you know, the top-rated investments, essentially, to where he's now in 3 weeks he's decided, no, we can also buy junk? What does that signify?
That signifies that the plan, I think, all along was to buy the junk. And again, he's learning from the masters, or just copying the masters in this game, of course, the Federal Reserve, which has been engaged in this for a number of years. And what was the Federal Reserve buying in their asset purchase program, their quantitative easing to infinity, was the mortgage-backed securities, which were basically toxic assets at this point, that they were taking off of the balance sheets of the banks and putting on their own balance sheet. And obviously, this has a number of different ramifications, one of which is clearly that, just as in the Federal Reserve's case and blowing up a housing, another housing bubble in the United States that continues to see residential prices skyrocketing in a number of markets, despite the fact that there are fewer and fewer home buyers. So work that one out. I mean, it's clearly because of the money that's been pumped into the mortgage markets by the Federal Reserve directly. But I think we're going to see a similar process happening in the Eurozone, where they're basically just going to blow up a residential mortgage bubble. RMBS, by the way, residential mortgage-backed securities. So just a different type of mortgage-backed security. And that's exactly what we're going to see in the Eurozone. And I think, again, what they're really doing, what they're really signaling to the banking community is that, hey, don't worry, we've got you covered. If you have any toxic stuff, we'll take it off your hands. And then you can start lending out into the markets again, which is supposedly what this is all about, getting the banks basically lending again and getting things booming. But I think that what we've seen in the Fed's example is that you will get a mortgage housing bubble, and you will get, obviously, an equities bubble with the running up of the stock markets. But underlying productive economic growth is somewhat more illusory and won't come from these paper promises from the central bank.
I think we're going to have to let it go at that. James, thanks very much for being on the program again. James Corbett from the CorbettReport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. I'm Alfred Addis. I'll be back mañana with Melody. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank, the producer, James Corbett. Good night.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? But still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.